Welcome to the I Did a Pod. Welcome. Hi there. It's a podcast about what else? The I Did a Rod. I'm your host, Casey Grove. The I Did a Pod is a production of Alaska Public Media. That was Michelle Phillips arriving in Ruby off the top, courtesy of our friends at iditarod.com. And, well, we've got a race, folks. Obviously, with 45 mushers out on the Iditarod Trail vying for positions, we've got a race. But at the very front, it's looking like a real battle setting up between Brent Sass and Dallas Seavey for first place. As the frontrunners head for the Bering Sea coast, we'll have a look at the teams reaching the Yukon River a bit farther back. We'll also talk about a pretty big scratch that happened there in Ruby, a bit about superstition among Iditarod mushers, and today we're going to talk a bit about the women mushers of the Iditarod, past and present, and of course, a dog profile and a listener question. First, though, we have some breaking news. I kind of have to laugh when I say breaking news because, as I've complained in the past, as soon as we get done with an Iditapod episode, things that I mentioned in the podcast have changed. In this case, I am very happy that things have changed, and that is because Jimbo, the dog from Richie Deal's team that was lost in Anchorage, he had been dropped from the Iditarod, flown back to Anchorage, and escaped during a routine vet check here in Anchorage. He has been found, safe and sound. Great news. We're so glad that Jimbo is okay after his time spent on the run. Anyway, it's Saturday, and Brent Sass and his team of Alaskan Huskies from that wild and free kennel have continued to press forward in the lead, hoping for their first Iditarod championship in seven tries, but with five-time and defending champ Dallas Seavey still trailing Sass and the unpredictability of the last quarter of the trail, most of which runs along the Bering Sea coast with harsh, quickly changing weather out there, it is still anybody's guess who will pull into Nome first under the famed Burled Arch, the finish line there. Sass has led this race since passing Dallas on the trail between Ophir and Cripple, and that's where both of them and a few others took their mandatory 24-hour layover. When we left off in our last episode, Sass and Seavey were both out of Ruby and onto the Yukon River, and since then they've mushed pretty consistently, with Sass blowing through Galena, kind of a busier little town compared to villages on the Yukon, and I think in Galena the checkpoint where the dogs would be bedded down if you stopped there is pretty close to the airport, so there's planes flying over. Sass decided to rest his dogs farther down the trail. Seavey rested before Galena. He also blew through, and then it was another 40-ish mile push to the village of Nulato. So Nulato and then the next checkpoint, the village of Kaltag, are interesting because mushers have to take another 8-hour layover somewhere on the Yukon River. And Sass's team went through Nulato, almost another 50 miles to Kaltag for their 8, with Seavey's team taking their 8 back in Nulato. For Sass right now, it's about maintaining that gap. From Nulato, they're off the river and through the woods to Unalakleet they go, and then that Bering Sea coast that I mentioned. Sass talked to Iditarod Insider about that in Kaltag, where it was cold, which is a good thing, but also starting to get windy.
Yeah, it's windy. Starting to feel cold though, that's kind of nice. I don't mind that at all. It's going to be nicer that it's a little bit chilly than the warm weather we've been having.
What are some of the challenges of what's coming up for you and your dogs?
Keeping a good pace and keeping them healthy and keeping weight, keeping them eating. All the normal stuff, you know, as we get to the coast, you're faced with a lot more weather potentially. Could be windy. Could be snowy, could be all kinds of different stuff. So yeah, I mean, I think basically it's normal dog care stuff, and then and weather, because the coast is always full of weather. So as we're finding out right now, it's starting to blow here. It's probably blowing even harder out there.
A race watcher that I was talking to this morning, who shall remain nameless, noted that it looked like Seavey had been cutting rest a bit on those normal run rest schedules, by about 15 minutes each time to try to take small bites out of Sass's lead. But then he's been giving some of that time back out there on the trail. So right now it's about maintaining speed, as the dogs will have run more than 700 miles by the time they get to Unalakleet, and they've got another 300 more to go. It's notable that Jesse Holmes is up near or at sometimes the front of the rest of the pack. Aaron Burmeister and team have also had a strong Iditarod Richie Diehl too, and a lot of the names we've been mentioning already, Millie Porcild, others. We're going to hear more from them in Ruby, where our trail reporter Lex Trinan had a chance to talk to those chase pack mushers before they hit the Yukon. Sass and Seavey had breezed through that first Yukon River checkpoint of Ruby on their way downriver, but a bunch of others stopped for longer rests in Ruby. It was sunny, a bit warmer at the time in the little Athabascan village, which helped mushers and dogs recover from the hilly terrain and storms earlier in the race. Lex visited the dog yard in Ruby to soak up some rays for himself and talk to mushers about how they were preparing for the next leg of the competition.
The sun was on a lot of mushers' minds as they tended their teams in the Yukon River village of Ruby near race mile 500. Dog teams rested on piles of straw in rows in a plowed-off parking lot nestled between a church and the community center. Mushers Jesse Holmes and Michelle Phillips traded observations about their dog's appetite as they spooned out food for their teams and repacked sleds.
Yeah, awesome. The key thing is they've been eating like crazy. This is the first
stop. Yeah, I noticed that with your team.
This is the first stop that I had two dogs that didn't eat very good.
And my team, normally they eat like crazy and they're not eating.
Like they just started eating, okay.
Yeah.
Holmes and Phillips rested their teams under a bright sun on Friday. Temperatures reached the upper 20s, and by the afternoon, many mushers had peeled off their hats and gloves. Those who had them wore sunglasses. Phillips says the warm weather has been a theme of this year's race.
It's been a hot race, which I found kind of hard, like just trying to feed differently and just not used to being so warm all the time. I'm getting trench foot from my feet sweating.
Ruby is the first checkpoint she stayed in for 150 miles or so, she says. Getting her socks off and letting her feet air out is a pretty high priority. The warmer weather isn't ideal for dogs to run in. They prefer temperatures closer to zero or even colder. But Holmes says the sunny afternoon is nice for resting.
Oh, it's getting real sunny out, and this is just I'm so thankful that the timing worked out, that I can do my eight here in the heat of the day. The dogs benefit from it. They can lay out in the sun and really relax, and the sun just kind of warms up their muscles. And if you were out on the trail in this, not good.
Holmes is busy sorting through his sled, trying to decide which gear to pull out as he sets out on the flat Yukon River, where speed is essential. Holmes is thinking he'd leave an extra set of boots behind, plus a set of 15 spare dog harnesses. He also says he's leaving a couple of dogs behind, the ones that can't quite keep the pace. The dogs and any abandoned gear will get shipped out. At over halfway through the race, Holmes, who trains outside of Cantwell, is starting to get competitive.
I'm having a good race, so I gotta stop being such a pack rat right now. I'm so hung up from living out in the bush of like always having extra everything in case things go wrong, you know?
Leaving Ruby just 10 minutes behind him is Antioch's Richie Diehl. Diehl set up straw for his team to rest out of sight of the main dog yard. They're tucked behind an abandoned building to give them some shade. He says he's tired of running in the hills.
I always like getting on the river. And I know it can throw a lot of different things, you know, with wind and everything, but I think it'll be good to get out there. I mean, just dealing with all the moguls and the wind and everything. Seems like we've been dealing with the moguls from the start, and it'll be nice to be on the river.
Fellow YK musher Pete Kaiser of Bethel is standing at the back of the dog yard, sizing up the other teams as well. Kaiser, the 2019 Iditarod champion, is running near the front of the pack this year, but not with the top teams, at least not yet. He says he's enjoyed catching up with Diehl in Ruby, though, and he likes Diehl's chances.
He's definitely in a good spot and has a good team, and there's a long way to go in this race. I've seen this race change many times, and there's plenty of miles left for things to change, so we'll see.
And now that the teams are on the Yukon River, Kaiser says, the real race is about to begin. Reporting in Ruby, I'm Lex Trinan.
And Lex was still there in Ruby when another fairly dramatic thing happened. And no, it didn't have anything to do with the town moose, thankfully. But one of the top mushers into Ruby was asked to sort of bow out. Hugh Neff. He was actually second into Ruby, but the race veterinarians there told him that they didn't like the look of his dogs upon their arrival. They just told him straight up that his dogs were not in good enough condition to run and that there were no other options, like taking a longer rest in Ruby. Officially, the race says Neff made the decision to scratch in conjunction with Iditarod race marshal Mark Nordman, but Neff, who Lex caught up with, sounded like he hadn't really had much of a choice.
Told that I had a choice of scratching or being disqualified, so for the sake of the mushing community, I decided to scratch.
Neff says his dogs had diarrhea when he arrived in Ruby and that they had actually started to recover.
I was on breaks most of the time. These girls are fast dogs. And at heart, if what happens to me, but it's all about the dogs, and I love these dogs.
As Lex was talking to him, Neff at the time was preparing to take his dogs to a friend's house in Ruby. The dogs are actually being borrowed from Iditarod veteran Jim Lanier. And what struck me as interesting about that is that Neff and Lanier are both Iditarod veterans that have been in positions in the past where they've had to prove themselves or re-prove themselves to get back into the race. Lanier had a series of attempts on the Iditarod where he had to scratch, one time needing assistance from another musher that put them both in a dire situation until they were rescued. So Lanier basically had to go back and re-qualify for the Iditarod. That means to go back out and do the mid-distance races again to prove that he could still handle the Iditarod. And then that turned into running the also 1,000-mile Yukon Quest as the oldest musher to complete it at 78 years old, Jim Lanier. Neff has won the Yukon Quest twice. I saw one of those myself. But then in 2018, a dog in his team died during the Yukon Quest. So that race ultimately made a decision to ban him for a time, citing poor dog care. And the Iditarod actually followed suit and banned Hugh Neff from the Iditarod. So Neff also had to requalify, ran the 300-mile Yukon Quest. And fast forward to this year, he was back in the Iditarod. He was, but is now out. Iditarod race officials issued a brief 3-sentence statement about Neff's scratch, did not provide additional details, and the race marshal, Mark Nordman, did not respond to requests for comment. And probably erring on the side of caution is the best thing for everyone, certainly the dogs. I hope the dogs are doing well, and I also hope Hugh Neff is doing okay too. So he's out, and I should mention so is Iditarod rookie Julie Onnen from Cantwell. She also scratched Friday up the trail in McGrath. Again, just a short statement from Iditarod saying that she had scratched in the best interest of her dog team. There are 45 mushers now remaining in the Iditarod as I'm recording this, that field having been whittled down a bit. And we haven't heard so much about specific things that happened to these mushers that have had to scratch other than Hugh Neff, but there's just a lot that can go wrong out there in a big long race like this. Sick dogs, an inopportune storm, broken sleds. There was a bit about that in the interview with Upa Yauk Raitan. But as much as a race could depend on improvisation and ingenuity, maybe it also depends a little bit on luck. So out on the trail, our reporter Lex Trinan wondered, along with all their gear, the required stuff, or anything else they're carrying, are mushers also carrying any good luck charms on their journey to Nome?
Three mushers I found in the dog yard at McGrath carrying good luck charms all had one thing in common. Their item was small and light. Sebastian Dos Santos Borges pulled out a thin chain with a nondescript medallion. It stamped with the number 23.
This always with me.
He says it's the number assigned to his dog Polar the year he ran another 1,000-mile race, the Yukon Quest in 2016.
It was an amazing dog, and I started the race with these dogs, and
Puller isn't on the team anymore, but his memory helps inspire Borges through this year's 1,000-mile challenge. Nearby, rookie Julie Annan also wears a medallion, though of a different kind.
A friend of mine gave me before I went on the Iditarod, and it's a St. Christopher. I believe he's the patron saint of traveling. He says, guide me in all directions. And his name is Ron O'Reilly, and he's a legend. And he told me, you know, keep that with me.
Annan met O'Reilly firefighting, a job she does during the summer.
He's really funny as well and pretty insightful person, but I don't honestly know him super well, but we've connected, and then we saw each other again in California as well fighting fire, and he'll call me every once in a while, and I mean, he's about 60 years old, and he's just a funny guy.
It wasn't clear if the medallion was working, at least at that point in the race. Annan was shivering in a wet down jacket as warm snow fell. She'd left her rain gear at the last checkpoint to cut weight in her sled after she'd had to drop a few dogs. and she was fighting a chest cold. Another rookie, Sean Williams, also has a sentimental keepsake with him, a keychain that belonged to his mother, Patricia, who passed away.
It's just a letter P with, yeah, it's like a rhinestone P. I mean, it's not really reflective of my mom's character, but she had it, so I have it now.
He says it reminds him of her and also keeps him grounded through the challenges of the trail he's sure to encounter.
It's kind of just a physical reminder that it doesn't really matter if the trail is bad, you know? I mean, look what we're doing. This is an incredibly beautiful thing, traveling down the trail. So, you know, thinking about good times and memories and all that keeps your mind in the right place.
Near Williams in the dogyard, Joe Taylor is preparing a sled. He doesn't carry a charm.
I don't. I probably should, but I don't.
Ryan Olson is also in that camp.
I think I like to just more remain kind of naive and be like, it's all going to be wonderful, and just try my best to forget that it's not going to be rainbows the whole time.
Unfortunately for Olson, her optimism didn't get her to the next checkpoint. She scratched in McGrath. Meanwhile, rookie Gerhard Tihart had a more practical reason for avoiding Lucky Charms.
There's a few things, small items, was close to me and said, I wish I can take this as a good luck charm. Then I think, if I lose this thing halfway through this race, I'll lose all confidence.
Reporting in McGrath, I'm Lucky Lex Trinan.
Well, no excuses then either, I guess, if you don't have a lucky charm to lose. That story reminded me of covering the Iditarod in 2014, which a lot of mushers say was the worst year that they had ever gone through the Dalzell Gorge and Farewell Burn due to low snow. The Norwegian musher Robert Sorley had returned to the Iditarod that year. He had previously won the race twice in 2003 and 2005. Then he took a 7-year break. He came back to one of the toughest, if not the toughest, Iditarods ever. And when he got to Nikolai, he told me the mushing he'd gone through to get there had scared him more than anything he'd seen on his day job, which is firefighter. Anyway, he was much more chilled out in Takatna later, eating pie, and I had already been talking to him in Nikolai, as well as before the race, for a story about his return to the Iditarod. So he was eating pie, and I was eating pie sitting next to him. There was a Norwegian reporter there, too. And so this is from the story that I wrote for the Anchorage Daily News. I'm just going to read part of it. It ended up with the headline, Takatna, Pie and Lucky Charms. Okay, here goes. Sorley was wearing a gold-colored necklace in the style of Mardi Gras beads that a girl had thrown to him as he left the restart in Willow. He said he plans to wear them for the whole race. Sorley asked fellow Norwegian Kari Jaeger for the right English word. My lucky charms, Sorley said. I asked him, is that what got you through the treacherous Dalzell Gorge and Farewell Burn? Yes. Then he said, you eat well, laughing as I finished a piece of raspberry pie. Jaeger said, maybe he could use you on his team. So just a little scene there in Takatna, some pie, some lucky charms. I know a lot of mushers would agree with this and other folks that follow the race. I really enjoyed Takatna, and I understand why they had to make that decision to not be a checkpoint this year due to concerns over coronavirus, maybe, to quote the Iditarod, in the best interest of their team. But I'd love to get back there someday, and maybe Robert Sorley will be back too. At the time, he was still the only Norwegian to have won the Iditarod. And since then, of course, we've seen Jor Leifseth Olsom win it in 2018 and then Thomas Werner in 2020. Olsom keeps a kennel in Willow, lives there most of the time, and maintains his Norwegian citizenship with a visa, I believe. But Werner had to fly his dogs to Alaska for the race, which turned into a major debacle in 2020 because, of course, international flights were shut down due to COVID. And he eventually got them and himself home in an old historic cargo plane months later, this plane that had been sitting in Fairbanks and was going to an aviation museum in Norway. Super interesting story at the crossroads of Iditarod and coronavirus. It's back there somewhere in the feed and online at alaskapublic.org if you want to look that up. But I'm sticking with Norwegians right now because a Norwegian in this year's Iditarod, Hanne Lyrek, is still the king of the rookies so far. And we've got another bonus extended interview with her in the works for tomorrow. Really interesting. She was born in Alaska, moved to Norway when she was 5, races sled dogs over there, has completed the long Finnmark Slopet and has won a shorter version of that race. She brought 16 dogs over to Alaska to do the Iditarod. There's Of course, only 14 dogs allowed in the race anymore, but I think she had two that maybe she would have been able to swap out before the race if she wanted to. And the same as how Vorner described it 2 years ago, traveling with a dog team from Norway means four dogs go with one person, so four people each with four dogs flew over. Seems complicated and stressful, but here she is having a great race as far as we can tell. Anyway, look for that interview by Lex Trinan from before the race coming up in your podcast feeds. Lurek is also one of the 17 women who started this year's Iditarod, which one of our former trail reporters, Ben Matheson, was speculating might be the highest proportion of women ever in the race. Although I'm not sure he's done the statistical analysis on that, but it does seem like a good-sized number of women mushers this year. And it is Women's History Month, after all. Happy Women's History Month to you all. We've already seen Apayauk Raitan as the first out trans woman to race the Iditarod, making history there. That's another extended interview in the feed. And women mushers are the subject of today's listener question. Real quick, though, thanks for all the questions so far. Remember, you can record a voice memo of your question, tell us who and where you are, and send that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Okay, now it's time for today's listener question.
I'm Alex Montanio from Baltimore, Maryland, and every March I look forward to getting immersed in all the Iditarod news and following along with the Iditapod. But March is also Women's History Month, and I know historically there have been some great women mushers, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about them and maybe what their experience was like. And also, who are the next great up-and-coming women mushers? Who's going to be the next woman that wins the Iditarod? Thanks.
As for top female mushers in the Iditarod, in recent times, until most recently, we would talk about Allie Zirkel from Two Rivers. She was a perennial favorite, always interesting to talk to, and competitively, she has had a bunch of top 10 finishes, like a bunch, and this pretty heartbreaking string of three second-place finishes in a row. In 2014, in that really tough race, she missed out on becoming the first woman musher to win the Iditarod since 1990 by just 2 minutes. It was wild. I was there. It was very confusing. And to explain, the GPS tracker isn't that accurate when mushers are that close together. So people were out on Front Street in Nome chanting, "Allie, Allie, Allie," thinking that they might be seeing her headlamp approaching in the darkness. It turned out to be Dallas Seavey instead. And Zirkel continued to place in the top 10, but then last year in what she said was going to be her last Iditarod, she took a major spill before Roan, was concussed, banged up, had to scratch from the race, and then was flown off the trail to get medical attention. No other woman has come closer since then, although Jesse Royer did take third place in 2020, the year we saw three women in the top 10 for the first time ever. Of course, Libby Riddles was the first woman to win the Iditarod back in 1985. She famously mushed through a blizzard to do it, a blizzard that I think other people were not willing to go through. Riddles has talked a lot about her experiences on another program that Alaska Public Media produces every week, actually, called Talk of Alaska. And I think the best thing I can say here is to check out alaskapublic.org and just search Libby Riddles, because she's been on as a guest a few times, and those interviews are posted there at alaskapublic.org. And then, after Riddles, along came Susan Butcher, who really had already been there. People already knew her as a competitive musher who had her trailbreaker kennel in interior Alaska and was the first person to summit Denali, North America's highest peak, with a dog team. But in 1986, Susan Butcher took over the Iditarod. She won the race 3 years in a row, placed second in 1989, then won it again in 1990. Just amazing. It cannot be overstated that her success as a woman and just as the first musher period to win three in a row, 4 out of 5, brought an unprecedented amount of attention to the Iditarod. In 1987, after her second win, Susan Butcher went to the White House to meet President Ronald Reagan in the Oval Office.
Hi, President Reagan.
The entire Alaska congressional delegation, all three of them anyway, were there with her. In this clip from the National Archives.
Mrs. Butcher has won the Iditarod twice the winner of Iditarod.
Yes, and you've been very kind and honoring me to bring me down there and honoring our sport.
Well, please. Wonderful.
We brought something for Nancy, too.
She actually presented a sweatshirt to President Reagan that had that saying, "Alaska, where men are men and women win the Iditarod."
Hey, I can't wait to give her that.
Reagan there saying, I can't wait to get rid of that. I'm sure just joking, but, you know. Hat tip to historian David Reamer, who tweeted that clip a few days ago. He writes a column for the Anchorage Daily News, tweets under the handle ANC_historian, if you want to find him. And while the history of Susan Butcher lives on, sadly, she's one that we lost far too early. She died in 2006 after a battle with a very aggressive form of cancer. Her husband, David Monson, told the New York Times, quote, "She knew that her kids, her girls, were going to be powerful, confident young women someday. She lived more in 51 years than some people do in 100. Well, there's a lot more we could say about Susan Butcher, but I want to get to the other part of that question now and the women mushers in the Iditarod today. And for that, I'm just going to let this tape roll. This is Paige Drobny in her 8th Iditarod now, has placed as high as 7th, twice, actually. Here she is talking to our Lex Trinan in Ruby.
Do you feel like women's mushing and women's Iditarod mushing is in a good spot? And, you know, it's there's good opportunities for women, or are there still challenges in that sense?
I mean, like, mushing is such an individual sport, and so I don't feel like there's barriers to entry other than monetarily, and that's the same across the board. Yeah, so I don't feel like there is. I feel like that's the kind of cool thing about it, is that it's one of the few places where we are competing on a level playing field, and
yeah, totally. And what about kind of the competition wise? You know, it's been a while since a woman has won the Iditarod. You've been knocking at the door, I guess, and just wondering, you know, what's it going to take for a female musher to win again? Is there any key to doing it?
Oh, man. You know, if I knew the key, I would probably be winning. I don't know what the key is. Yeah.
Be the boys.
Girls rule, boys drool.
Are there any advantages to being a woman on the trail? Or being a musher, I guess, too.
Well, I mean, I don't know what it's like to be a man, so it's harder for me to say what my advantages are versus a guy's advantage. But, I mean, I feel like, you know, if you're going to go by stereotypes, women are more nurturing than men. And so I think, I'm not saying that they take better care of their dogs, but there's just a different kind of, I don't know, everyone out here babies their dogs, so there's not really, like, this is probably not true at all.
Cool. Well, thanks so much. I'll let you go.
And for a little bit more on the subject of women mushers, here's another woman musher, Yukoner Michelle Phillips, also in Ruby.
I was going to ask, because we as part of the show, we do like a listener question segment, and yeah. People are asking about the women of the Iditarod, and you are a woman of the Iditarod.
Right.
And I guess the general question is, what's it like to be a woman on the Iditarod? Is it, and what do you feel about how women are doing right now on the Iditarod? You know, we haven't had a winner for a while, but right. there's lots of participation.
Yeah, there's a lot of really incredible women mushers up and coming. I think the future looks really bright. You know, Susan Butcher and Libby Riddles paved the way. Definitely, I think there's a lot of women coming into the sport who bring a lot to the sport, and it's cool to see. Yeah.
You're one of them, one of the top female contenders. You know, how do you feel about your own competitive spirit? Are you gunning for a win one day?
Yeah, I'm competitive regardless of anything. That's the way I was raised. Obviously, as you get older, you're like, I wonder how much longer I can do this, you know, but we'll see.
Is the hardest thing just your body, or what's the limitation for your...
Just maybe like saving some money to retire one day instead of spending it all on dog racing.
Fair enough.
Yeah. It's not like a win sport as far as money goes. Yeah.
Is it ever weird at like checkpoints, you know, with like different, I don't know, you guys are all always camping in the same bunkhouse, right? You know, how is that?
I've been in the sport for 22 years and I've raced always against men, so it's like whatever.
I don't even think about it. Yeah. I'm just a musher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are there any, you know, challenges that you see for women in the sport or the sport in general?
Well, yeah, when we have to pee and it's 40 below. Definitely.
And you don't want to walk all the way to the outhouse?
Yeah, or you're on the trail.
I don't really want to end on that, but any closing thoughts?
Right. No, just it's great. It's one really nice thing about the Iditarod this year. Last year I ran the Iditarod, is the village is welcoming us back, and it's really nice to see the villagers and volunteers, and it's just really nice to feel normal, and that feels so great. Yeah. So yeah, I hope it continues.
Really cool to hear from both of them, two very down-to-earth people, like a lot of dog mushers, and willing to answer the tough questions like, how does it work going to the bathroom? The realities of life on the back of a sled, I suppose, out there in the middle of nowhere. Well, I promise this is all going somewhere, and that is straight to our dog of the day. The dog's name is Butcher, named after the legendary musher, and she's an important part of Anya Redano's team. Redano has scratched from this year's race, but Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George had talked to her for a totally different story. That's coming up on a future episode of the pod. And she asked her about any special dogs on her team.
Butcher. She's named after the famous Susan Butcher. She came, like, I got her from Jeff King, actually, too, when she was, like, 8 weeks old as a puppy. And that was, like, from a big litter. Like, I think there was 11 or 12 puppies in that litter. And they were all named after, like, they were called the Musher Greats litter. So they were all named after famous Iditarod winning mushers. So this one is Susan Butcher, and there was a Libby Riddles. And then I actually have two of her brothers. This one, black one, is her brother Wilmarth, after Dick Wilmarth, the first one who won Iditarod. And then that other big guy that was barking at him the whole time, that's Dino, after Dean Osmer. So there was, like, all these different ones. And so she came to me when she was a wee puppy.
Did you pick her out?
Yeah, I did pick her out. And then I raised her, and she's just, like, very special to me because I feel like we are, like, a lot alike. Like, her and I, we have a lot of, like, things in common, and she's just, like...
Like what?
Like, we're both, like, not, like, you know, a lot, like... A lot of dogs here, they love to be hugged and cuddled and snuggled, and she likes it to some extent, but then she wants her space, and I'm, like, the same way, that way. We're both a little bit grumpy in the morning, you know, not exactly early morning people, but, like, she has, like, always been, like I just feel like a really strong personal connection with this dog. Like, there's a lot of times where it's just weird. Like, I look at her and she, I know she knows exactly what I'm thinking. Or like this summer, we took, like, a hike up Hatcher Pass with some friends and their dogs, and we took a break, and I was sitting in the grass, and all the dogs were running around and chasing ground squirrels, and my friends were running around to get the dogs back because they weren't listening. And she was just, like, she just came back and sat next to me, and we both watched the whole, like, mayhem. And it was just, like, really sweet because, like, she, like, cared more about being with me than, like, being with her doggy friends and chasing ground squirrels. And it's just, like, but, yeah, so this will be her third Iditarod. She ran both my previous Iditarods and finished both of them, and she runs mostly in lead, like lead or swing or anything like that, but she's, like, one of my main lead dogs too.
And is that determined by, like, her personality and temperament?
Yeah, it's her personality and the drive of a dog to, like, want to run up front, you know, and make good decisions and like, just have this forward drive, not and enough confidence to have, like, a whole pack of dogs running behind you, you know, and, like, learning the commands and understanding the commands. And
it's also, like, a lot of responsibility for a dog.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah, and that's, like, and they have to be up for that, you know, so not every dog can do that. It doesn't even mean that, like, a dog has to be particularly extra smart, you know, like, it's more like I think a mental stability thing, and, like, they have to have the heart, you know, to, like, do that. And then, and she,
been, like, river crossings.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and, like, there's, like, I mean, every lead dog has, there's, like, special, man, is that a mosquito already?
Oh yeah. I saw
one. Oh, sorry. No, I squished it. There's like, you know, like different type of lead dogs too. Like you have a lot of people have like different dogs for different scenario trails. She is like extremely versatile. Like I could use her everywhere, but she's like, she's maybe not like, she looks very fat, but like she has like a very steady, like she, and she's like, she makes smart decisions. There's other ones like this guy, he likes to run up lead front in front too, but he's not super smart. Like he gets sometimes like too like wild about things, and he's like, you know, like other teams or if there's something happening, you know, then he like doesn't listen anymore or whatever. So I wouldn't like take him particularly on a like a particularly difficult terrain trail or where I know there's a lot of things happening. But he like runs up front and pulls hard.
And how old is she?
She's 6 now. Yeah, she turned 6 in August. Yeah, and this will be her third. Our third and her third, I don't know. Yeah.
Do you think she has got more races in her?
Yeah, I'm sure she would have like at least one or two more in her. Yeah, that's like, she's very athletic and like, and just like in general, like she's just a steady soul.
Can you describe her to me, like what she looks like?
Yeah, so she like definitely has more like a houndish look to her for a sled dog. She has like, you know, this like shorter coat. It's like a dense coat. Like she definitely has a double husky coat, but it's definitely a little bit shorter. So she needs like a jacket earlier than other dogs maybe. She has kind of like floppy ears, they're kind of floppy, the tips at least. And I would say like she's kind of like brownish gray, or I don't know, maybe, yeah, brownish gray,
kind of like black and blonde.
Yeah, black and blonde. Yeah. Are you a black and tan? But yeah,
hey, you're such a good girl.
Brown eyes.
She has very, very sweet eyes.
Yeah. No, she is a very sweet dog.
That's Anya Redano describing her dog Butcher, named after the famous Iditarod champion Susan Butcher. Sounds like that's her favorite dog. And again, Redano has actually scratched from this year's Iditarod, but whatever. This is about the dogs. Well, I'm going to have to go hang out with my dog now. His name is officially Theo, which is better than what I've been calling him lately, which is Booby Butt. A derivative of Boo-Boo, which came from Bubba, which used to be Big Boy, I think. Not really sure how that all happened, but it did, so it's a good thing that he has a respectable name on paper. And happy 5th birthday to Tegan's dog Bagel, that sweet adventure terrier Bagel. Happy birthday to the rest of you and all your dogs too, depending on where you're at here in space-time. For us, we're going to be taking the day off from the Iditapod tomorrow, as the race will surely be marching on up the coast. We will be back soon, though, I promise. That theme music, it's by the band Sassafras. Thanks, as always, to the rest of the Iditapod team, Lex Trinan, Tegan Hanlon, and Jeff Chen. Thank you to you for listening. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
NASCAR.